Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
So you may have noticed a lot of people have a lot of opinions about the choices Black people are making in the Democratic primary, on why Southerners lined up behind Biden and why Bernie can't seem to connect with Black people over the age of 30. Well, I spoke recently with somebody whose work is actually dedicated to building Black political power. I hosted a live conversation here in the green space at WNYC. And given all the chatter about Black voters, this seems to me like a good time to share that event with you as well. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. Rashad, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rashad Robinson runs a racial justice organization called Color of Change, which has been widely celebrated as one of the country's most innovative social change groups. Among other stuff, maybe you heard of them as the people who ran that campaign that got Bill O'Reilly kicked off of Fox News. But I also wanted to talk with Rashad because he grew up in the suburbs of Long Island, in the exact same area where we began this show.
But few regions of the country have been hurt worse than Suffolk, you know.
Way back during the 2016 campaign, when we were following supporters of then-candidate Donald Trump.
And it wasn't until I went to his rally, and it totally blew me away. I left there crying.
By the way, if you want to hear that episode, text the word suburbs to 70101. That's suburbs to 70101.
Yeah, I grew up in Suffolk County, Long Island. People are like, Black people in Suffolk County? And I'm like, yes, my family, lots of other families, but not that many families.
Like me, he's a child of the Great Migration. How'd your family make it north?
So Southern Virginia, the farm fields of like Southern Virginia, sort of outside of Charlottesville and Richmond, sort of in between. And there were farm fields there and farm fields on Eastern Long Island. And Black folks made it out there to work on those farm fields. Riverhead, where I grew up, has a large Polish population, so there were cauliflower and potato farms that they worked on. There were also duck ranches.
Duck ranches?
Yeah, if you've
What's
ever
a duck ranch?
If you've ever like looked at a menu and seen Long Island duck, it's like a very like well-known thing. But ducks have to live someplace, and it is not a nice place to live, and that is where Black people had to live. ducks are not clean animals, and duck ranchers had to move ducks every so often, but they needed places where there were water, which is why Long Island, with both like its actual like surrounding of waters, but also its like rivers and wetlands, was always a really fertile place to both raise and cultivate ducks. But, you know, Black folks would live in these places where they were like long shacks that they would cut up and they would slap sides on them, and then they would be outhouses. And so my dad grew up on the duck ranch. My mom always likes to remind him that she did not grow up on the duck ranch.
So our first season of the podcast was set in Suffolk County, where you grew up. And, you know, one of the things that someone told us in that season was that the suburbs were created to preserve white innocence. And so growing up there and in the middle of that, how did it shape the way you think about racial politics?
Oh, I mean, being reminded that you are Black was such a clear thing. And my parents, we integrated the neighborhood that we were raised in. And you know, for the first several months of it, we would regularly have nails at the end of our driveway or things that were like reminders that we like didn't belong or shouldn't be there.
And this is not 1950.
Yes. I mean, you know, I'm 41. I don't like to say that.
I
paused. So you can like see. Yeah. And I like
the point is it's relatively recent history.
It's relatively recent history. And to be treated like constantly like a newcomer in a town where your grandmother went to the high school is like a very clear understanding of how power works, right? Long Island, for me, really did shape my understanding of power and race, but it also, more than anything, taught me how to organize. It taught me how to not mistake presence for power, not mistake people patting you on the back or saying nice things or letting you in the room or giving you praise for stringing together a sentence for people to actually see you as a valuable contributor to society. Mm.
Presence versus power. This is such an important distinction when talking about Black people in the Democratic Party. There's this cycle we always go through. We're running it again right now, actually. If you watched the returns on Super Tuesday, or you read the punditry all the following week, you got hammered with one inescapable phrase.
The Black vote.
Repeated like some kind of incantation.
Absolutely destroying Bernie Sanders with Black voters.
Summoning the authority of the base of the Democratic Party.
African-American voters.
The all-important Black vote.
Black voters, they're in your demographic. They're under
30. Which people seem to care about with such intensity, just about right now, every 4 years. It's like the Black History Month of electoral politics. And then, just like at the end of every February, the country moves on. On to worry about the elusive swing voter, which is invariably some form of white person who's worried about what they'll lose if society changes too much.
Candidates, so if they don't come to these communities, they're definitely leaving votes on the table.
This season, we're looking back at the years following the Civil War and at the unresolved debates that we are still having. And here's one that really strikes me as I watch the Democratic primary. The debate among Black people about whether, or at least how, we ally ourselves with white liberals. Back in the Civil War era, the Republican Party was the party of abolition, the people who wanted to break the power of Southern oligarchy. And to do that, they built this brand new political coalition. And it leaned heavily on pretty much the same demographics as today's Democratic Party does. That's Black people in the South and liberal whites in the North and in the West. But when I asked historian Leanna Keith about this alliance, she said Black people were skeptical about it from jump.
You know, to trust the Republicans was a risk because they didn't necessarily have the best interests of Black people at heart. Their reasons for wanting to stop the spread of slavery were mixed.
The Republicans wanted to check the South's power over the country, but they weren't necessarily interested in Black freedom and equality. Leanna says, nonetheless, Black activists decided they had more to gain than to lose by working with Northern white liberals in the Republican Party.
It becomes more and more integrated over time. More and more Black people are convinced that Republicans can represent them and will. And temporarily, by the end of the war, there is a kind of a real Black Republican movement.
The awkward political partnership that followed the war remains in place today. It's just the foundation of the Democratic Party instead of the Republican Party. And every election season, Black people still ask, where do we stand in this relationship? Do we have actual power? Or is it just presence? And Rashad told me he thinks about that in every aspect of his life.
I look at some of the ways in which my family in the South has had more progress and opportunity than my family who ended up to a more integrated North. I mean, I graduated from Riverhead High School. My grandmother graduated from Riverhead High School, like integrated schools in a way that my family in the South didn't. But, you know, my family in the South are teachers and went on to historically Black colleges and have had a very different sort of pathway. And so all of these sort of questions are just deeply complicated and don't lend themselves to quick sort of public policy solutions.
What do you think it is that led some of the folks that stayed in the South to actually have a better trajectory to you? What is that about?
I think that there were more Black-controlled communities in the South, and the South is where Black people controlled their own schools. And it didn't mean that it was great, but it did mean that the focus became different.
Thinking about power.
The power that you own your own property, the power that you control your own schools, the power that you have local newspapers that serve you and local media that is designed for you. All of these things are part of building communities that, you know, are healthy and robust.
Some folks will hear this conversation and think, oh, great, well, segregation was better. You had more power in segregation, including Black folks. Yeah. You know, and it's a complicated tension.
Yeah, because, like, false integration Integration that doesn't change power dynamics, integration that is forcing people to a table that is not designed for them and doesn't care about them is not really integration, right? And so, and even integration in of itself, the idea that we're just going to integrate you into things and it's not going to change, right? It's like you have to shake up the salad dressing, right? And it changes. Otherwise, if you just put things on top of each other, it doesn't taste good. And so,
I love this metaphor.
So like the fact of the matter is like some of the ways in which integration happened didn't actually change the rules. I mean, this is actually what I mean when I talk about the not mistaking presence for power. You know, presence is visibility, awareness. It's us being in the room. It's shout outs from the stage. It's diversity for diversity's sake, right? We just did this study on crime TV with USC. We looked at all the crime TV shows across the season, 26 shows, 300 and something episodes, looked very deeply at the role, the way that these shows really fuel a negative incentive structure around race.
Look, I know where you're coming from.
No, you don't know where I'm coming from. There's no way you can know where I'm coming from.
Don't you dare presume to know what's in my head.
No matter what you say, Captain, you're not black and you're not.
There's been a lot of conversations in Hollywood around diversity. So actually, these shows on air are very diverse. The front of the camera. In fact, if you've ever watched a crime procedure like Law & Order or CSI, you'll notice that there's way more black judges on those shows than ever existed in real life. Like, just like counting the black judges.
Has the jury reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
You're like, if we had this many black judges, that would say something very different about, like, education, race, and opportunity in America. But, like, they've heard the demands around diversity, right? And this is the difference between presence and power. They've heard the demands around diversity. Like, okay, we're going to make all... The judge, that's a really important position. Let's make that a 65-year-old black woman. She's not going to really have a backstory. Like, what would it be like for a 65-year-old black woman to be a judge?
Of New York City.
Same speeches, Mr. Kuby. Bail is set at 10,000. Moving on.
But, like, that's interesting. She's not going to have any backstory. She's going to sit there. She's going to, like, say a couple of things. She's going to look very stately. And then a show like Law & Order, which has an all-white writer's room. Law & Order SVU has an all-white writer's room. It's SVU. It's about sex crimes. Its writer's room is all white and 60% men. They can send justice through the mouth of this symbolic, stately, elderly black woman who's a symbolic for justice happening in this room so we don't feel like it's not happening. And they have sort of told us that they've met some diversity. But that is why presence and power is so different, because we can get tricked into thinking that something has happened that hasn't actually happened. We can think that a black president means that racism is solved for. We can think that, like, America cheering on black celebrities means that they love black people as much as they love black culture, and they can hate black people and love black culture at the same time. And in fact, those two things don't even have to contradict themselves at any point.
That certainly brings us to the election. Mm-hmm. and the difference mm-hmm. between presence and power.
Yeah.
The black vote.
Yeah.
Why am I already tired of this conversation? It feels like the kind of thing where there's so much discussion about black people and how we vote, but at the same time, it feels like we are erased in that conversation. Why do I feel that way?
Because, I mean, you said something, and I'm glad you started off by calling it the black vote, because they're talking about black votes, not black people. Black people in service of something else, not black people as people and communities, right? And so if you are seeing someone as a voter or a consumer and not a person, then you're going to do things over time to treat them that way. And they are going to feel that and believe that. And, you know, we are going to be dealing with such a heightened level of disinformation this election season, you know. And I say disinformation and not misinformation. Misinformation is things we've always had to fight. Like, don't show up to the election, black people, if you owe child support or if you, like, haven't paid your taxes. And they'll put up flyers in black communities.
Robocalls that used to
robo-calls.
Go out.
I'm calling to let everyone know that Governor O'Malley and President Obama have been successful. We're okay.
We've had to push back against that. Or you can vote up till December 1st this election. You know, all the misinformation.
Relax. Everything is fine. The only thing left is to watch on TV tonight.
Disinformation is something a little different, and that's like the Democratic Party has ignored you, so what do you have to lose by voting for Trump or staying home?
This is a very real concern that Rashad and other racial justice activists are talking about right now. And I mean, first off, you may remember back in 2016, a big part of the Russian meddling in our election, that was disinformation targeting black people.
Hillary Clinton. Most of the black people in America thinks that Hillary is the one who's going to protect them, and Hillary is the one who's going to fight for them. But hell no. Hillary Clinton is one of the dirtiest liars.
They were trying to convince us that neither party actually cares about us, so why vote?
Doesn't care about anyone. Hillary is being...
Now, I would look crazy as a racial justice person going into black communities and be like, the Democratic Party has never ignored you. Because I don't even know how I would say that with a straight face. Yes, the Democratic Party has taken black people for granted. And so the question isn't like denying that. It is like leaning into that and then telling, walking people through the project of trying to get them to stay home because there are people who actually want even worse for you than some party structures that have taken you for granted.
Rashad argues what's crucial is that the Democratic Party focus its attention on the part of its coalition that it simply cannot win without, black people.
I mean, I think people forget that, like, Obama lost white youth to Mitt Romney. He lost white youth to Mitt Romney. I know there's always this talk about, like, the youth vote for Obama, but it was fueled because young people are the most diverse generation ever, and he was powered by black and Latino, primarily young people and API young people, and that's how he had overwhelming performance. And so the path to victory is expanding the number of people who did not show up in 16, of the base, and getting those folks out. And that is, like, what I'm worried about. I'm worried about... what is the case for those folks to actually believe that electoral politics matters to them? Because the fact of the matter is, if you were making minimum wage at your job back in 2013, the change in presidency hasn't probably negatively affected your life.
You're still making minimum wage.
You're still making minimum wage. You might have more hours now. You might have multiple jobs, and sometimes what ends up happening in elite rooms in New York, D.C., San Francisco, and L.A., as we develop the case for how we reach people and engage people, and we tell them a story about what Donald Trump has done, but we sometimes can't tell them what we've done for them. Like, we paint a story of yesteryear when we were in charge that is not really a story that people think was all that magical in their lives. And so I just think that sometimes we tell ourselves a story about where we're at. We tell ourselves a story about who's already with us because we expect them to be with us. How dare they not be with us after everything we're doing for them? And we always haven't asked ourselves the question of what have we actually done for them? Like, how has their life fundamentally been made better by the work that we've done? They're also seeing Trump talking about black voters in ways that is different than other Republicans in the past.
To expand equal opportunity, I am also proud that we achieved record and permanent funding for our nation's historically black colleges and universities.
Almost acknowledging power,
yes,
in a weird way.
Yes, acknowledging.
Like, he's almost talking to black voters as though...
yes.
From perspective of their power as opposed to their...
And he's not just talking to... he's also talking to, like, suburban white voters.
Right.
So I'd be like, look, I still talk to black people.
Yes.
Why am I racist? I probably talk to black people more than, like, anyone in your family does. And so, like, how am I the racist one? And so,
but ironically, the tone of it...
the tone of it, yes.
Is different, like, than the way Democrats talk.
Every time he talks about unemployment, every single time he mentions black unemployment...
we've done more for African Americans in 3 years than the broken Washington establishment has done in more than 30 years.
Every time. He, like, the left spent years not wanting to say black. And, you know,
particularly on economic issues.
Black American unemployment has reached an all-time low in the history of our country.
Absolutely. And so I'm not worried that Trump is going to, like, win the black vote, right? That's not actually what he needs to do. He needs to shave off enough percentage points, depress enough people to maybe stay home. And then what ends up happening is that the pathway to victory is small, because the fact of the matter is that the white vote hasn't went towards a Democrat since LBJ signed Civil Rights Act. And that's not like a mistake.
Coming up, Rashad and I reimagine presidential candidates as Hollywood blockbusters.
Whoa. What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
When we left our conversation, Rashad and I were thinking about young Black voters, the kind of people who were such an important part of Barack Obama's first campaign. In this primary, Black people over 30 have decisively lined up behind Joe Biden at this point. But the data available so far suggests that young people of color, including Black people, still do support Bernie Sanders, just as they did in 2016.
I do think the establishment has given us Bernie Sanders. You know, whether it's been Democrats in charge or Republicans in charge, corporations have been able to make more by doing less. And all of us have to do more and we make less. And so, like, yes, we have more Black millionaires than we've ever had, but actually Black-white income has continued to expand. The gap has continued to go the other way, right? Like, school segregation has continued to go the other way. All these sort of indicators for people being able to rise up and have more opportunity, it has gone the other way. And so, for me, the story that sometimes is being told about, you know, people just wanting to go back to the good old days of whatever. I mean, yeah, sure. Like, if Donald Trump is like the big budget Hollywood movie with bombs and distractions and plot twists that you kind of like accept a lot of the plot twists, that's what his followers do. And Hillary was the documentary. It says, if a documentary says, I stand up for the little guy, and afterwards says it was paid for by Wall Street and Walmart, you're like, I can't take that documentary. Even if there was a lot in the documentary that was great and believable.
Where are you going with this?
And then Obama is like the romantic comedy, where everything is like more beautiful and picturesque and more lovely than it is in real life. And you know love doesn't really work that way.
But it feels good.
But it feels good. And you will like, and right now, you would have watched that movie on
repeat. Absolutely.
And so if I like lay out each of those like brand archetypes, right, like a big budget Hollywood movie, yeah. Staying true to one's brand is important, sometimes way more important than even some of the policies, because people oftentimes think about what they want and believe, and then they put it into an archetype, right? Mm-hmm. And so Bernie has been consistent, and that's the thing about Bernie. And so,
right.
You know, and I think that like Bernie, there's a question about how he gets any of these things done that he's talking about. Two, he is working to build a diverse coalition, but hasn't proven that coalition can be armed as a welcoming place for people who are struggling with some of the things that he is putting out. And people can't be made to feel stupid or attacked when they have questions. They need to be felt like they're listened to and they're engaged and common ground is built.
Which brings us to the political discussion around Joe Biden. Black Southerners essentially saved his campaign, first in South Carolina and then on Super Tuesday. And since then, a lot of progressives, and Bernie Sanders supporters specifically, have essentially accused Black Southerners of voting against their own interests with a candidate who's not been great on racial justice. And as we keep seeing, all kinds of Democratic voters, including Southern Black people, have just been laser-focused on one thing, defeating Donald Trump. The differences lie in voters' beliefs about how to get that done. And Rashad says there's another widely shared goal, which may become an even bigger factor, thanks to the coronavirus outbreak.
I think for maybe 30% of the public, that the first thing that they kind of want is to return to something that feels normal. And that means not waking up every single day with the next scandal of the day and the next crazy thing. And that means that the message from a candidate that says, I am going to be the person that can manage the systems. I will, like, get things done and not embarrass you. Things will work because I know how to run things, right? And so for some people, they are certainly prioritizing a level of getting things done. And then they're, for a moment, people were like, oh, well, maybe this, like, guy from Indiana could do it. Once they start digging into, like, the fourth largest city in Indiana. You're like, maybe the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana might not be ready to run things on day one. He's the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana. Now he's running for president. I think it's just important to say. smaller than Harlem. yeah. And so I think that people are looking for like someone that can like manage things. And I do think that was some of the early appeal that Warren had when she had all the plans. And then I think when people expected her to explain them better and there was like some of that challenge, that didn't happen. No one expects that from Bernie. That's like not the brand archetype.
Right.
I also think that people are overlearning the lessons from 16. So first and foremost, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. But the popular vote doesn't become president. She also, at the end, was like trying to win Arizona and Georgia and thought she was going to run up the numbers and did not put resources into Milwaukee, Philly, and Detroit.
Black cities with lots of black people voting.
And so if she was in Milwaukee, like Philadelphia and Detroit in deep ways, what we might be having a conversation about right now is how the Republicans and the Never Trumpers sunk that election for the right and how the Republicans can't come together. I mean, it's like, it was like 66,000 votes or something.
Well, it's actually about 79,000 votes. That's Trump's combined margin of victory in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
I think, like, that yes, people are afraid of Donald Trump having another 4 years, and we should be. There is nothing that I want to, like, be light about, but I'm just very clear-eyed about some of the analysis people have about the path to winning can feel off. Now Donald Trump is a lot stronger than he was 4 years ago. He has a Justice Department that will be suppressing votes in all sorts of ways. He has levers of power that are strong. He has two-thirds, that last poll I just saw, like two-thirds of people think he's going to win again. Like, he has a lot of energy. And the one thing I fear about all of this is that regardless of who wins, this will be an election where the vast majority of the people on the other side see the victory probably as illegitimate.
Yeah. And what's going to happen on the other end of this election, whoever wins?
Yeah, I think we are in for some real, real challenges.
Rashad, thank you very much for this conversation.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was edited by Marianne McCune. A special thanks to the Jerome L. Green Performance Space for hosting this conversation and to the Black Employees Resource Group of New York Public Radio for sponsoring it. Our executive producer is Karen Frillman. Casey Means is our technical director. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Jessica Miller, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. With help this week from Michelle Harris and Kim Nowaki. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. And do keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Ray. Thanks for listening.
The United States of Anxiety's health coverage is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health that ensures everyone in America has a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org.